This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the United States, called on Israel Thursday to hold new elections, saying he believes Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way in the country's bombardment of Gaza.
The Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then. And the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in the chamber, rebuked Schumer for his suggestion that Israel hold new elections.
It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel.
After Schumer's Senate speech, White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby said there would be no immediate change in U.S. policy toward the conflict, which has included sending arms to Israel. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has appointed his longtime economic advisor to be the new next prime minister in the face of U.S. pressure to reform the Palestinian Authority as part of Washington's post-war vision for Gaza. Mohamed Mustafa, a U.S.-educated economist and political independent, will head a technocratic government in the Israeli-occupied West Bank that could potentially administer Gaza ahead of eventual statehood. But those plans face major obstacles, including strong opposition from Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israel-Hamas war that is grinding on with no end in sight. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Voting in Russia's presidential election got underway early on Friday. We get the details from VOA's Alexis Strope.
Voters are heading to the polls in Russia for a three-day presidential election that is all but certain to extend President Vladimir Putin's rule by six more years after he stifled dissent. The election takes place against the backdrop of a ruthless crackdown that has crippled independent media and prominent rights groups and given Putin full control of the political system. It also comes as Moscow's war in Ukraine enters its third year. Voters will be casting their ballots through Sunday at polling stations across the vast country's 11 time zones, as well as in illegally annexed regions of Ukraine. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
As fires broke out and violence continued in the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, a powerful gang leader threatened political leaders who are set to take part in a planned transitional council and govern the Caribbean nation. Under pressure from the United States, Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced Monday that he would step down once the transitional council was in place. The White House confirmed Thursday that Henry is in Puerto Rico. The calm following Henry's announcement eventually gave way to a resurgence and violence, including an attack on a police academy Thursday. Haitian authorities have expanded a nighttime curfew until Sunday. An appeals court has denied Trump White House official Pete Navarro's bid to stave off his jail sentence on contempt of Congress charges. We get the details from the AP's Jackie Quinn.
A federal appeals court in Washington says Peter Navarro cannot remain free. While he challenges his conviction on charges, he refused to cooperate with a congressional investigation into the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Navarro was found guilty of defying a subpoena for documents and a deposition and has been ordered to report to prison by March 19th. He's the second Trump aide sentenced to prison. Advisor Steve Bannon, who went before a different judge, was allowed to remain free pending his appeal. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The Somali extremist group Al-Shabaab says its fighters attacked a hotel in the capital Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab said on its Telegram channel that its fighters managed to penetrate the SYL hotel, which is located not far from the presidential palace in a normally secure part of Mogadishu. The hotel is patronized by government officials. There was no immediate word on casualties. Attacks in the seaside capital had reduced in recent weeks amid a beefing up of security there. Al-Shabaab, which opposes Somalia's federal government, is responsible for many lethal attacks on hotels and other places over the years. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
the U.S. Senate floor, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer calls for change in Israel to achieve long-lasting peace.
At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process.
Plus, Turkey has a new stealth fighter, but
analysts warn developing a stealth combat jet is far more challenging than making drones, and the Khan jet still has a long way to go before it's combat ready.
And U.S. military officials are keeping a close eye on Haiti, where incidents of violence continue despite efforts to establish a transitional government. Today is Friday, March 15th. And this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling on Israel to hold new elections, saying Israel must make significant course corrections to achieve lasting peace with the Palestinians, criticizing the actions of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
The fourth major obstacle to peace is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has all too frequently bowed to the demands of extremists like Ministers Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and the settlers in the West Bank. I have known Prime Minister Netanyahu for a very long time. While we have vehemently disagreed on many occasions, I will always respect his extraordinary bravery for Israel on the battlefield as a younger man. I believe in his heart he has his highest priority is the security of Israel. However, I also believe Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take the precedence over the best interests of Israel.
Schumer, a long and strong supporter of Israel, is the highest-ranking Jewish elected U.S. official.
At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel. At a time when so many Israelis have lost their confidence in the vision and direction of their government. I also believe a majority of the Israeli public will recognize the need for change. And I believe that holding a new election, once the war starts to wind down, would give Israelis an opportunity to express their vision for the post-war future.
He added that it would be a grave mistake for Israel to reject a two-state solution and urged negotiators in the Israel-Gaza conflict to do everything possible to secure a ceasefire, free hostages, and get aid into Gaza. Following Schumer's remarks, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said that the U.S. Congress is an independent branch of the government, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's call for new elections in Israel are his comments, and not those of the administration of President Joe Biden. Netanyahu's Likud party rejected Schumer's call for new elections in Israel, saying Israel was not a banana republic and that Netanyahu's policies had wide public support. Now, for analysis, I earlier spoke with Jeremy Pressman, political science professor at the University of Connecticut.
I thought it was quite striking to hear Senator Schumer's comments. He is known as a very strong supporter of the state of Israel. And he, you know, he expressed some of that support in his words today. But to hear the intensity of his criticism of the current Israeli government was quite striking.
Does this pose any kind of difficulties in U.S.-Israel relations, given that there has been, you know, somewhat of a split between Biden and Netanyahu in recent days over the situation in Gaza and the looming offensive towards Rafah?
I think it adds a little bit to what we've seen already, but I think for the most part, the split that's important is between the president and the prime minister, between Biden and Netanyahu. So Schumer's words reinforce a bit the position that President Biden has been taking, but I don't think it offers any kind of fundamental change. I mean, President Biden is caught between Israel's war policy and the reality of domestic politics in the United States today. And maybe Schumer belatedly is recognizing that as well.
In terms of domestic policy turning to Israel,
from the day the hostages were taken by Hamas, which is a U.S. designated terrorist organization, there have been protests by Israelis for the Israeli government to do more. And even just the other day, there were additional protests by Israelis to have the government do everything in its power to get the hostages home. Does this kind of comment from abroad, you know, from the United States, from this high-ranking member, put extra pressure on the Netanyahu government to do more?
I think it puts a little bit of additional pressure, but for the most part, the Netanyahu government has rejected the idea that it should make one major agreement to end the hostage crisis. If the price that Israel is going to have to pay is a permanent end to the current conflict, the Netanyahu government has argued that it still has more to do to defeat Hamas in this current battle, and so they don't want to commit to a final ceasefire at this point, or at least that's what we've been hearing for the last couple months. So I don't think it fundamentally changes that. At its base, the Netanyahu government has argued that the use of Israeli military force is the best way to free the remaining hostages. I think what we've seen in these first several months is that that's not the case. Most of the hostages were freed as a result of the pause that took place, the negotiated pause that was indirectly negotiated between the government of Israel and Hamas. So I don't think the evidence really backs that up, but at least publicly they've stuck to that position. And I don't think Senator Schumer's comments alone will change that.
And one last question. As someone who is an expert in this area, given everything that's happened in the last few months, what things are you closely watching to see what the next phase or a next major development may be?
The first thing I'm watching is whether Israel moves on an additional attack on Rafah. That would be a major intensification. The conflict has been debilitating the last few weeks, and we see Palestinians continuing to suffer from that, but it has been somewhat less intense than it was in the first couple months of the conflict. So any kind of escalation in Israel's military operations in Gaza would be one thing that I'm looking for. The second thing is to see if there's any kind of negotiating breakthrough. It seems like we're stuck right now between what Hamas demands and what Israel is willing to concede. Obviously, mediators, Qatar, Egypt, the United States are still working on that. So looking for any kind of sign in that realm that some kind of negotiations or negotiated agreement can move forward is also important.
Jeremy Pressman is a political science professor as well as the director of Middle East Studies at the University of Connecticut. He's also the author of The Sword Is Not Enough, Arabs, Israelis, and the Limits of Military Force. Professor Pressman, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In another development, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has appointed his longtime economic advisor to be the next prime minister. The appointment on Thursday came in the face of U.S. pressure to reform the Palestinian Authority as part of Washington's post-war vision for Gaza. Mohammed Mustafa is a U.S. educated economist as well as a political independent. He will head a technocratic government in the Israel-occupied West Bank that could potentially administer Gaza ahead of eventual statehood. And Israel also on Thursday defended its policies on allowing aid trucks into Gaza and called on the United Nations to send more convoys of assistance to the war-ravaged territory. VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes it from here.
Gilad Goren, head of the Israeli military body in charge of Palestinian civilian affairs, said Thursday that there is no limit to the amount of aid that can enter into Gaza.
We work closely with the international community to ensure that humanitarian aid reaches the people of Gaza, and we have placed no limit on the amount of aid that can enter into Gaza.
Trucks carrying aid to the war-battered Gaza Strip moved Thursday at the Kerem Shalom crossing between Egypt, Israel, and Gaza after the much-needed humanitarian aid was inspected before entering the strip. Israel is under growing international pressure to ease restrictions on aid entering Gaza, particularly the northern half of the territory. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
VOA has additional as well as ongoing coverage of the war between Israel and Hamas on our website, voanews.com. And still to come, sitting down with an Academy Award winner.
Their 30 hours of footage became the basis for 20 Days in Mariupol, which just won an Oscar for Best Documentary, a first for any Ukrainian filmmaker.
This is VOA News. We're also following these other stories from around the world. Former Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says he's going to put together an investor group to try to buy TikTok after the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that would ban the popular video app in the U.S. if its China-based owner doesn't sell its stake. TikTok did not immediately respond to a request for comment. A Voice of America reporter was among more than 200 U.S. citizens sanctioned on Thursday by the Russian government over what it said was anti-Russian activity. National security correspondent Jeff Seldon was among several reporters, including some from the Washington Post and New York Times, to be included in this latest spate of sanctions against U.S. citizens. The sanctions come ahead of Russia's March 15th to 17th presidential elections, where Russian President Vladimir Putin is expected to win a fifth term. A federal judge on Thursday denied former U.S. President Donald Trump's request to dismiss a criminal case that charges him with illegally holding on to classified documents after leaving the White House. The ruling came just hours after a hearing in which his lawyers argued that the central charge in the case is improperly vague. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Turkey's defense industry claims to have entered the exclusive club of stealth jet manufacturers with last month's first flight of its Khan fighter jet. But as Dorian Jones reports, analysts say the stealth jet has yet to prove itself.
Ankara is presenting the successful test flight of its stealth Khan fighter jet as a national triumph. The Khan was developed in response to the U.S. decision barring Turkey from buying the American-made F-35 combat jets after Turkey bought Russian anti-aircraft missiles. Turkey says its rivals are rearming with America's new jet, and Ankara said it had no alternative. Mesut Jarshan is a presidential advisor and professor at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
The excessive armament of the Greece is a big threat for the Turkey and agency, the balance of power. On the other hand, ongoing wars in the Middle East have necessitated the urgent modernization of air force. However, we have to underline that the U.S. embargo about the F-35 regarding the Gaza, the sanctions.
Turkey's defense industry has already established itself globally with its armed drones, now widely used in conflicts from the Caucasus to Syria to Africa. The drone development came after the United States refused to sell its Reaper drones to Turkey. Analysts say Ankara sees its defense industry as vital to its foreign policy. Suat Delgin is a retired senior naval officer and now an independent foreign policy and defense analyst. He says Turkey thinks the less dependent it is on foreign countries in the defense industry, the more autonomy it will gain in its foreign policy. He says in this respect, Turkey is primarily trying to be as independent as possible. Ankara, meanwhile, presents the Khan jet as a breakthrough for its rapidly growing defense industry, placing Turkey among the few countries that build a stealth jet. Analysts say the Turkish arms industry remains relatively small, still relying on foreign imports for key components. Siner Özkarashahin is an independent defense analyst.
There's been quite a significant improvement, but also the Khan incident illustrates the foreign dependency in critical subsystems and critical segments, such as the power packs, the engines, still continuing.
American engines power the Khan jet, but Ankara claims to be developing its own. Analysts say Turkey's already identifying markets for the Khan. Again, Sina Özkarashahin.
What's important that it will fill in the demand in alternative markets, in countries that cannot access the F-35 technology, be it economic reasons, be it political reasons. So Azerbaijan and Pakistan and possibly Ukraine, are some examples where can really make a difference.
Turkey's drones followed a similar strategy in finding a niche market. But analysts warn developing a stealth combat jet is far more challenging than making drones, and the Khan jet still has a long way to go before it's combat ready. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. military officials are keeping a close eye on Haiti, where incidents of violence continue despite efforts to establish a transitional government. We hear now from VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden.
Fire trucks arriving at the main prison in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince following reports of a fire, the latest sign of distress in a nation immersed in social and political crisis. In Washington, a top U.S. military commander offered words of hope.
With the announcement that has come and the political negotiations that have been happening and occurring, the violence has been tamped down somewhat over the past couple of days.
U.S. Southern Command's General Laura Richardson appearing before lawmakers with the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Hopefully that continues on a positive path.
If not, she says,
U.S. Southcom has a wide range of contingency plans, so we're ready for whatever would be required.
That includes plans to help evacuate civilians and prepare for a mass migration out of Haiti, though Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh says no orders have been given.
Our mission right now with the personnel that are on the ground is to shore up security at the embassy.
U.S. forces this past Sunday were sent in to enhance security at the U.S. embassy while also evacuating non-essential personnel. Jeff Selden, VOA News. The Pentagon.
That's the roaring sound of the SpaceX Starship rocket, which is designed to eventually send astronauts to the moon and beyond, launching on Thursday. The ship completed nearly an entire test flight into space on its third try, but was destroyed during its return to Earth after making it further than it had before. The two-stage rocket ship, which is taller than the Statue of Liberty in New York, blasted off from the company's Starbase launch facility near Boca Chica on the Gulf Coast of Texas on an uncrewed flight to space, where it executed a key stage separation maneuver nearly 3 minutes later at an altitude of about 72 kilometers. SpaceX later confirmed that the craft was destroyed during atmospheric reentry.
No splashdown today. But again, just it's incredible to see how much further we got this time around.
NASA watched with keen interest as the space agency needs Starship to succeed in order to land astronauts on the moon in the next two or so years. This new crop of moonwalkers, the first since last century's Apollo program, will descend to the lunar surface in a Starship, at least the first couple of times. And finally, we end the week where it began, with the Academy Awards. On Monday's program, we shared a big first for Ukraine as Mstislav Chernov's 20 Days in Mariupol won the Best Documentary Oscar. The film is a first-person account of being in the eastern Ukrainian city during the first weeks of Russia's full-scale invasion. VOA's Christina Shevchenko talked with Chernov in this story, narrated by Anna Rice, to round us out.
When Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, Mstislav Chernov was part of an Associated Press team documenting the invasion in and around Mariupol. The AP crew, including Chernov and photographer Yevgeny Malaletka, filmed the bombing of maternity ward number 3 on March 9th. Their 30 hours of footage became the basis for 20 days in Mariupol, which just won an Oscar for Best Documentary, a first for any Ukrainian filmmaker.
I felt that the room was so silent that I could hear a pin hitting the floor. It was the most silence I heard in that room during the whole ceremony.
Chernov believes the film's power lies in its lack of any political agenda.
These are real people, so when you bring that to the cinema community, when you bring that thought, I mean, you keep talking to the cinema community about that. I think that's what hits hardest, when they see real people behind the characters, behind the images.
Chernov has been with AP for a decade, and 20 Days in Mariupol became his film debut. His unflinching views of the Russian bombing of the city showed the world the realities of urban Oscar ceremony.
Before the ceremony, I've received so many messages from Ukrainians in my social networks and emails saying, we hope you get that stage. It wasn't about the Oscar. It wasn't about the victory or the statue or the film. It was about the stage.
In his acceptance speech, Chernov said he was perhaps the only reluctant Oscar winner, saying he would trade it all if it meant war had not come to his homeland. But he also hopes the film will help all survivors begin to heal.
This is a collective experience for those who lived through tragedies, and they finally were able to face something they've deeply, deeply repressed and tried to forget. And you cannot start your treatment, psychological treatment, when you're repressing your memories. You have to bring them up.
Chernov also says Mariupol was just one tragedy among many.
Other tragedies happened. Bakhmut happened, then Mariinka happened, and Soledar, and Bukhledar, and Avdiivka. So every time we see a city being occupied, every time we see a city being destroyed by Russian bombs, we come back to Mariupol.
Chernov says he is working on two other films and won't stop working until the war ends. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked Chernov for his contributions, adding that his film shows the truth about Russian terrorism. Anna Rice and Kristina Shevchenko, Los Angeles and Washington, VOA News.
And this has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, we thank you for joining us. For pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform, as well as online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Following a trip to Singapore, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, and Brunei, Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Daniel Crittenbrink told reporters that many of our friends in Southeast Asia are concerned about the situation in the South China Sea. He said that concern was particularly acute in those countries making claims of sovereignty in the face of China's sweeping claims to practically the entire South China Sea.
We've seen in a number of instances where the People's Republic of China has taken a number of steps in the South China Sea that both run counter to international law, but that also utilize coercion to intimidate partners in ways that we find deeply unacceptable and destabilizing.
Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink said the United States has a threefold response to meeting the concerns sparked by such behavior.
First, we continue to focus on our diplomacy, including with partners in ASEAN, to make sure that all countries, including all claimants, base their claims in international law, that all claimants commit to recognizing and respecting freedom of navigation, freedom of overflight, and the peaceful resolution of disputes.
Secondly, we spend a great deal of time, effort, and money investing in building maritime domain awareness, said Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink. We believe that the more countries are able to understand what is happening in their maritime domains and defend their own interests, we further promote stability across the region.
Thirdly and finally, the United States continues through our own operations to be physically present in the region on a daily basis, and we continue to fly, sail, and operate everywhere that international law allows, demonstrating thereby that all countries share those same rights.
Our goal, declared Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink, is to promote peace and stability, security and prosperity, respect for international law and peaceful resolution of disputes, but also ensure that countries have their own ability to protect their sovereignty and their own interests. And we think if we do that, we maximize our chances of preventing miscalculation and conflict, and again, promoting peace and stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.